pieces. The man started toward her, threw them. Amara threw the gladius at him and saw his sword rise up to parry at her side. She dove for the back of the tent, now holding only the little knife, and with a quick move slashed a hole in the canvas. She slipped through it and heard herself whimpering in fear as she began to run. She flashed a glance behind her as Aldrich's sword opened the back side of the tent in a pair of strokes, and he came through after her.
"Guards!" the swordsman bellowed. "Close the gate!"
Amara saw the gate start to swing shut, and she slipped to one side, ran down a row of white tents, gathering up her skirts in one hand, cursing that she hadn't seen fit to disguise herself as a boy so that she could have worn breeches. She looked behind her. Aldrich still pursued, but she had left him behind like a doe outstripping a big slive, and she flashed a fierce smile at him. Caked dirt fell off of her as she ran for the nearest wall, and she prayed that she could get enough of it off of her to call to Cirrus. A stepladder rose up to the wall's defensive platform in front of her, and she took it in three long strides, barely touching it with her hand. One of the legionaries, a guard on the wall, turned toward her and blinked in shock at her. Amara made a ridge of her hand, let out a shout, and drove her hand into the man's throat, never slowing. He tumbled over backward, gagging and choking, and she ran past him to the wall and looked over. 10 feet down to the ground level, and then another 7 or 8 feet of ditch lay beneath her. A crippling fall if she didn't land correctly.
"Shoot!"
someone shouted, and an arrow hissed toward her. Amara threw herself to the side, grasped the top of the wall with one hand, and vaulted it, throwing herself out into empty space.
"Cirrus!"
she called, and felt the stirring of wind around her, finally. Her fury pressed up against her, turned her body to a proper angle, and rushed down beneath her, so that she landed on a cloud of wind and blowing dust, rather than on the hard ground of the ditch. Amara gained her feet again and ran without looking back, stretching, covering the ground in leaps and bounds. She ran to the north and the east, away from the practice fields, away from the stream, away from where they had left the Gargant and its supplies. The trees had been cut to make the walls of the encampment, and she had to run across nearly 200 strides of broken stumps. Arrows fell around her, and one struck through a hanging fold of her skirts, nearly tripping her. She ran on with the wind always at her back, Cirrus an invisible presence there. Amara reached the shelter of the trees and paused, breathing hard, looking back over her shoulder. The gates of the camp swung open, and 2 dozen men on horses, long spears gleaming, rode out and turned as a column straight toward her. Aldrich rode at their head, dwarfing the riders nearest him. Amara turned and ran on through the trees as fast as she could. The branches sighed and moaned around her, leaves whispering, shadows moving and changing ominously around her. The furies of this forest were not friendly to her, which made sense, given the presence of at least one powerful woodcrafter. She would never be able to hide from them in this forest when the trees themselves would report her position.
"Cirrus!"
Amara gasped.
"Up!"
The wind gathered beneath her and pushed her up off the ground, but branches wove together above her, moving as swiftly as human hands joining together, and presented her with a solid screen. Amara let out a cry and crashed against that living ceiling, then tumbled back to the ground. Cirrus softened her fall with an apologetic whisper against her ear. Amara looked left and right, but the trees were joining branches everywhere, and the forest was growing darker as the roof of leaf and bough closed overhead. The beating of hooves came through the trees. Amara struggled back to her feet, the cut on her arm pounding painfully. Then she started running again, as the horsemen closed in behind her. She couldn't have guessed how far she ran. Later, she only remembered the threatening shadows of the trees and a burning fire in her lungs and her limbs that even Cirrus's aid couldn't ease. Terror changed to simple excitement, and that transformed by degrees to a sort of exhausted lack of concern. She ran until she suddenly found herself looking back, and into the eyes of a mounted legionare not 20 feet away. The man shouted and cast his spear at her. She stumbled out of the path of the weapon and away from the horseman into a sudden flood of sunshine. She looked ahead of her and found the ground sloping down for no more than 3 or 4 strides and then ending in a sheer cliff that dropped off so abruptly that she could not see how far down it went or what was at the bottom. The legionare drew his sword in a rasp of steel and called to his horse. The animal responded as an extension of the man's body and pounded toward her. Amara turned without hesitation and threw herself off of the cliff. She spread her arms and screamed, "Cirrus! Up!" The wind gathered beneath her in a rush as her fury flew to obey, and she felt a sudden fierce exultation as, with a screaming whistle of gale winds, she shot up, up into the autumn skies, her wake kicking up dust devils along the ridge that cast dirt up in the face of the unfortunate legionare and set his horse to rearing and kicking in confusion. She flew on, up and away from the camp, and paused after a time to look behind her. The cliff she'd leapt from looked like a toy from there, several miles behind her and one below. "Cirrus," she murmured, and held her hands before her. The fury gusted and swirled a part of itself into that space, quivering like the waves rising from a hot stone. Amara shaped that air with her hands, bending the light until she was peering back at the cliff through her spread hands, as though she stood no more than 100 yards away. She saw the hunting party emerge and Aldric dismount. The legionare who had seen her described her escape, and Aldric squinted up at the sky, sweeping his eyes left to right. Amara felt a chill as the man's gaze paused directly upon her. He tilted his head to the man beside him, the woodcrafter knight from before, and the man simply touched one of the trees. Amara swallowed and swept her hands back toward the rebel legion's camp. Half a dozen forms rose up over the treetops, which swayed and danced beneath the winds as though they had been the bushes in a holtwife's herb garden. They turned, and as one they sped toward her. Sun glinted off of steel, armor and weapons she knew.
"Knights Aeris," muttered Amara.
She swallowed and let her hands fall. Normally she would have been confident of her ability to outrun them, but now, wounded and already exhausted in body and spirit, she was not so sure. Amara turned and bade Cirrus to bear her north and east, and prayed that the sun would set before her foes caught up to her. Chapter 3. Tavi slipped out of his room, down the stairs, and through the silence of the last shreds of night before dawn. He entered the cavernous shadows of the great hall, noting a faint glow of light in the kitchens beside the great hall. Old Bitter rarely slept more than a few hours a night, and Tavi heard her moving through the kitchen, preparing it for the coming breakfast meal. He unbolted the door and left the great hall for Bernard Holt's courtyard. One of the Steadholt's dogs lifted his head from the empty barrel he used as a kennel, and Tavi stooped to scratch the old hound's ears. The dog thumped his tail against the barrel's interior and laid his head back down to sleep. Tavi drew his cloak over his shoulders against the chill of the dying autumn night and opened the postern door to leave the safety of Bernard Holt. The door opened to reveal his uncle Bernard, leaning casually against the doorway, dressed in leathers and a heavy green cloak for a day in the wilderness beyond the Steadholt's fields. He lifted an apple to his mouth and crunched into it. Bernard was a large man with broad shoulders and the heavy muscles of hard labor. His dark hair, cropped close in a legion cut, showed a fleck or two of gray, though none such appeared in his close-trimmed beard. He wore a quiver of hunting arrows at his side, riding beside his legion-issued sword, and he carried the stave to the lightest of his bows unstrung in his hand. Tavi drew up short, with a flutter of apprehension. Then he spread his hands, silently conceding the victory to Bernard, and then offered his uncle a faint smile.
"How did you know?"
Bernard returned the smile, though there was a wary cast to it.
"Fade saw you drinking a lot of extra water last night after you came in so late, and pointed it out to me. It's an old soldier's trick to get up early."
"Oh," Tavi said. "Yes, sir."
I counted the flocks, Bernard said. Looks like we might be a few heads short.
Yes, sir, Tavi said. He licked his lips nervously. I'm going to bring them in now.
I was under the impression that you had done so last night, since you marked down a full count on the tally slate.
Tavi's cheeks grew warm and he felt glad for the dimness.
Dodger led his ewes and their lambs out last night when I was trying to bring the south flock in. I didn't want you to worry.
Bernard shook his head.
Tavi, you know that today is important. The other steadholders will be arriving for the truth find, and I don't need any distractions.
I'm sorry, Uncle. Why don't you stay here, then? I can find Dodger and bring him back in.
I don't like you wandering around the valley alone, Tavi.
I'm going to have to eventually, Uncle. Unless you planned on following me around for the rest of my life.
Bernard sighed.
Your aunt would murder me.
Tavi gritted his teeth.
I can do it by myself. I'll be careful and be back before noon.
That's not really the point. You were supposed to bring them in last night, Bernard said. What kept you from it?
Tavi swallowed. I'd promised to do someone a favor. I didn't have time to get them both done before dark.
Bernard sighed.
Crows, Tavi. I really thought you had done a lot of growing up this season. That you were learning to handle responsibility.
Tavi felt suddenly sick to his stomach.
You're not going to gift me the sheep, are you?
Bernard said, I don't begrudge you getting your fair dues. I am glad to help you get started with your own flock. But I'm not just going to throw them away. If you can't show me that you'll take care of them properly, I can't give them to you.
It isn't like I'd be keeping them long.
Perhaps not. It's the principle of the thing, lad. Nothing comes free.
But Uncle, Tavi protested, it's my only chance to make something of myself.
Bernard grunted.
Then you probably shouldn't have chosen to...
He frowned.
Tavi, what did you need to do that was more important than the flocks?
Tavi's face grew warmer yet.
Bernard arched an eyebrow and said,
Oh, I see.
See what?
There's a girl.
Tavi knelt and tightened the straps on his boots to hide his scowl and said,
Why would you say that?
You're a 15-year-old boy, Tavi. There's always a girl.
No, there isn't, Tavi insisted.
Bernard mused over that for a moment and shrugged.
When you want to talk about it, let me know.
He pushed himself off the wall with one shoulder and strung his bow with one leg and the pressure of an arm.
We'll discuss your gifting later. Where do you think we should pick up Dodger's trail?
Tavi drew his leather sling from his pouch and put a couple of smooth stones into the pocket of his tunic.
Won't Brutus be able to find him?
Bernard smiled.
I thought you said you could do this on your own.
Tavi frowned at his uncle and scrunched up his nose, thinking.
Cold's coming on and they know it. They'll want evergreens for shelter and for food. But the Gargants were turned out to forage on the southern slope of the valley and they won't go anywhere near Gargants if they can help it.
Tavi nodded.
North. Dodger has taken them into the pine hollows over the causeway.
Bernard nodded in approval.
Good. Remember that fury crafting is no substitute for intelligence, Tavi.
And intelligence is no substitute for a fury, Tavi muttered sourly.
He kicked at the ground, scuffing up a small cloud of dust and dried, dead grasses. Bernard laid a heavy hand on Tavi's shoulder, squeezed, and then started walking north, down the old lane worn by the passage of carts and draft animals and feet.
It's not as bad as you think, Tavi. Furies aren't everything.
Says the man with two of them, Tavi said, following him. Aunt Isana says you could challenge for full citizenship if you wanted to.
Bernard shrugged.
If I wanted to, perhaps. But I didn't come into my furies until I was almost your age.
But you were a slow bloomer, Tavi said. I'm way past that. No one's ever been my age and furyless. Bernard sighed.
You don't know that, Tavi. Relax, boy. It will come to you in time.
That's what you've told me since I was 10. If I'd had furies of my own, I could have stopped Dodger and still...
He choked down his anger before he could blurt out the words. Uncle Bernard glanced back at Tavi, smiling with only his eyes.
Come on, lad. Let's pick up the pace. I need to be back before the other steadholders arrive.
Tavi nodded and they broke into a mile-eating lope down the winding lane. The sky began to lighten as they passed the apple orchards, the beehives, and then the northern fields laid fallow for a season. The lane wound through a forest of mostly oak and maple, where most of the trees were so ancient that only the most meagre grass and brush could grow beneath them. By the time the pre-dawn pale blue had given way to the first tints of orange and yellow, they had reached the last stretch of woods before leaving the lands of Bernard Holt. There the forest was not so old, and smaller trees and brush, some of it still living despite the lateness of the season, stood thick and heavy. Golden and scarlet leaves covered the dried skeletons of the smaller brush, and the naked sleeping trees swayed in a chorus of gentle creaking. And then something in his surroundings brought an odd kind of pressure to Tavi's senses. He stopped and let out a short, warning hiss of breath. From a full jog, Bernard abruptly dropped to a crouch, and Tavi instinctively followed suit. Bernard looked silently back at Tavi, cocking an eyebrow in a silent question. Tavi stayed on all fours and crawled up beside his uncle. He kept his voice to a whisper between panting breaths and said, "Up ahead, in that last stand of trees by the brook. There's usually a covey of quail there, but I saw them heading along the lane."
"You think something spooked them out?" Bernard said.
He murmured,
"Cypress,"
and flicked his right hand toward the trees beside him in a signal to the lesser of his two furies. Tavi looked up and saw a shape glide down from one of the trees, vaguely humanoid and no larger than a child. It turned pale green eyes toward Bernard for a moment, crouching down like an animal. Leaves and twigs seemed to writhe together to cover whatever shape lay beneath them. Cypress tilted its head to one side, focusing on Bernard, and then made a sound like wind rustling through the leaves and vanished into the brush. Tavi was winded from the run and struggled to slow his breathing.
"What is it?"
he whispered. Bernard's eyes slipped out of focus for a moment before he answered.
"You were right. Well done, boy. There's someone hiding near the footbridge. They've got a strong fury with them."
"Bandits?"
Tavi whispered. His uncle's eyes narrowed.
"It's Cord."
Tavi frowned.
"I thought the other steadholders were supposed to be arriving later today. And why would they be hiding in the trees?"
Bernard grunted, rising.
"Let's go find out."
Tavi followed his uncle on down the road. Bernard walked with quiet purpose toward the causeway, as if he had every intention of traveling past the hidden men. Then, without warning, he spun to his left, arrow in hand, drew back the bow and loosed a gray-feathered shaft at a clump of bushes and detritus a few paces from the near side of the small stone footbridge that crossed a murmuring brook. Tavi heard a scream, and the leaves and bushes thrashed wildly. A moment later, a boy about Tavi's age emerged from the bushes, one hand clenched upon the seat of his breeches. He had a broad, strong build, and a face that would be handsome if it had been less petulant. Bittern, of Cordholt, Cord's youngest son.
"Bloody crows!" the boy howled. "Are you insane?"
"Bittern," called Bernard in obviously feigned surprise. "Oh, dear. I had no idea that was you back there."
From further down the trail, a second young man rose out of hiding, Cord's eldest son, Arik. He was leaner than his brother, taller, and several years older. He wore his hair pulled back into a tail, and pensive frown lines had already established themselves between his eyebrows. He watched Bernard warily and called,
Bitten? You all right?
The boy screamed, furious.
No, I'm not all right. I'm shot.
Tavi peered at the other boy and muttered to his uncle,
You shot him? Just grazed him.
Tavi grinned.
Maybe you hit him in the brain.
Bernard smiled a wolfish smile and said nothing. From still further back in the brush, leaves crackled and dead wood snapped. A moment later, Steadholder Cord emerged from the bracken. He wasn't terribly tall, but his shoulders seemed too large for him, and his brawny arms looked unnaturally long. Cord wore a patched and faded grey tunic, badly in need of a thorough washing, and heavy gargant hide leggings. He wore his symbol of office, the heavy chain of a Steadholder around his neck. The chain was smudged and looked greasy, but Tavi supposed that it made a better match for his unkempt greying hair and patchy beard. Cord moved with an aggressive tension, and his eyes were cold with anger.
What the crows do you think you're doing, Bernard?
Bernard waved a friendly hand at Cord, but Tavi noted that he held an arrow along with the bow in his other.
Little accident, he said. I mistook your boy there for some kind of robber lurking by the road to attack travellers.
Cord's eyes narrowed.
Are you accusing me of something? Of course not,
Bernard drawled, his smile not touching his eyes.
This is just a misunderstanding. Thank the great Furies no one got hurt.
He paused for a moment, his smile vanishing before he said quietly,
I'd hate to have someone get hurt on my land.
Cord snarled, a sound more bestial than human, and rolled forward a furious step. The ground under his feet rumbled and quivered, restless little hummocks rising and falling as though some kind of serpent slithered about just beneath the surface. Bernard faced Cord without looking away, stirring, or changing his expression. Cord growled again, and with a visible effort choked back his anger.
One of these days I'm going to get upset with you, Bernard. Don't say things like that, Cord,
Tavi's uncle replied.
You'll frighten the boy.
Cord's eyes flicked to Tavi, and the boy felt suddenly uneasy under that intense and angry regard.
He come into any furies yet? Or are you finally going to admit what a useless little freak he is?
The simple comment pierced Tavi like a thorn, and he opened his mouth to make a furious response. Bernard settled his hand on Tavi's shoulder and said,
Don't worry about my nephew.
He glanced at Bitten.
After all, you've got other concerns. Why don't you head on down to the Steadholt? I'm sure Isana is getting something ready for you. Think we'll stay here a while,
Cord said.
Maybe eat a little breakfast.
Suit yourself,
Bernard said, and started on down the lane. Tavi followed close behind them. Bernard ignored Cord until they had crossed the footbridge.
Oh, Bernard said, looking over his shoulder. I forgot to mention that Warner already came in last night, Cord. His sons are on leave from the Legion so that they could visit their father.
Bring them on,
Bitten snapped.
We'll tear them apart.
Cord delivered an open-handed blow to Bitten's face that knocked the boy to the ground.
Shut your mouth.
Bitten shook his head, dazed and scowling. He didn't answer Cord or look at his father as he stood up.
Go on down, Bernard said. I'm sure we can get everything worked out.
Cord didn't reply. He beckoned his sons with a curt gesture and started down the lane. They followed him, and Bitten cast a harsh, hateful glare at Tavi as he walked.
Freak!
Tavi clenched his hands into fists, but let the comment pass. Bernard nodded his approval, and they waited as Cord and his sons headed down the lane to Bernard Holt. As they watched, Tavi said, They were there to attack Warner, weren't they, Uncle?
It's possible, Bernard said. That's why your aunt asked Warner to come in last night. Cord is desperate.
Why? It's Bitten that's been accused, not him.
Rape is a realm offence, Bernard answered. Cord is the family head, and he shares responsibility for offences against the realm. If the truth find shows that there needs to be a trial and Bitan is judged guilty, Count Graham could remove Cord's claim to Cordholt.
You think he'd kill to protect it? Tavi asked.
I think men who lust for power are capable of almost anything.
He shook his head.
Cord sees power as something to satisfy his desires, instead of a tool to protect and serve the people beholden to him. It's a stupid attitude, and it will eventually get him killed, but until then it makes him dangerous.
He scares me, Tavi said.
He scares anyone with good sense, boy.
Bernard passed his bow to Tavi and opened a pouch on his belt. He withdrew a small glass button from it and dropped it over the side of the footbridge and into the brook.
Ryl, he said firmly, I need to speak to Isana, please.
They waited there on the bridge for several moments before the sounds of the brook began to change. A column of water rose straight up out of the brook, taking on human form as it did so, until it had formed into a liquid sculpture of Tavi's aunt, Isana, a woman with the youthful form and features of a strong watercrafter, but the bearing and voice of a mature adult. The sculpture peered around, eventually focusing on Bernard and Tavi.
Good morning, Bernard. Tavi.
Her voice sounded tinny, as if it had come down to them through a long tube. Aunt Isana, Tavi said, bowing his head politely.
Sis, Bernard drawled. We just ran into Cord and his sons. They were waiting around in the brush near the north bridge.
Isana shook her head.
The fool can't be serious.
I think he was, Bernard said. I think he knows that with what Bitan did, Graham will get him this time.
Isana's mouth twisted into a wry smile.
I doubt having a woman appointed the truth-finder for this crime has pleased him either.
Bernard nodded.
You might want to make sure someone is close, just in case. They're coming down the lane to you now.
Isana's image in the water frowned.
When will you return?
Before noon, with luck. Before dinner, otherwise.
Try to hurry. I'll keep things civil for as long as I can. But I'm not sure anyone but you can make Cord back down without shedding blood.
I will. Be careful.
Isana nodded.
And you. Old Bitter says that Garados and his wife are brewing up a storm for us, by nightfall at the latest.
Tavi shot an uneasy glance to the northeast, where the towering mountain of Garados sat glowering down at the inhabitants of the Calderon Valley. Its upper slopes were already growing white with ice, and clouds obscured the topmost peaks, where the hostile fury of the towering mountain conspired with Lilvia, the fury of the cold gales blowing over the great sea of ice to the north. They would gather in clouds like herds of cattle, feed them to anger on the day's light, and drive them down over the inhabitants of the valley in a fury storm as the sun set.
We'll be back long before then, Bernard assured her.
Good. Oh, Tavi?
Yes, Aunt Isana?
Do you have any idea where Berita would have acquired a fresh garland of holly bells?
Tavi shot his uncle a guilty glance and blushed.
I guess she must have found them somewhere.
I see. She isn't yet of marrying age. She's too irresponsible to care for a child. And she certainly is too young to wear holly bells. Do you think she'll be finding any more?
No, ma'am.
Excellent.
Isana said rather crisply.
We'll discuss the matter when you return.
Tavi winced. Bernard held on to his chuckle until the water sculpture had lowered itself back into the brook, the contact with Isana ending as it did.
No girl, eh? I thought Fred was the one walking out with Berita.
He is, Tavi sighed. She's probably wearing them for him. But she asked me to get them for her, and, well, it seemed a lot more important at the time. Bernard nodded.
There's no shame in making a mistake, Tavi. provided you learn from it. I think you'd be smart to think of this as a lesson in priorities.
So?
Tavi frowned.
So what?
Bernard kept smiling.
What have you learned this morning?
Tavi glowered at the ground.
That women are trouble, sir.
Bernard's mouth opened in a sudden merry roar of laughter. Tavi looked up at his uncle and cast him a hopeful grin. Bernard's eyes shone with merriment.
Oh, lad, that's about half of the truth.
What's the other half?
You want them anyway, Bernard said.
He shook his head, the smile lingering in his eyes, his mouth.
I did one or two stupid things to impress a girl in my day.
Was it worth it?
Bernard's smile faded without giving the impression that he had become any less amused. It simply turned inward, as though what he was smiling at existed only within. Bernard never spoke of his dead wife, or their children, also gone.
Yes. Every bruise and every scrape.
Tavi sobered.
Do you think Bitan's guilty?
Likely,
Bernard said.
But I could be wrong. Until we've had the chance to hear everyone speak, we have to keep an open mind. He won't be able to lie to your aunt.
I can.
Bernard laughed.
You're quite a bit smarter than Bitan, and you've had a lifetime of practice.
Tavi smiled at his uncle. Then he said, Sir, I really can find the flock. I can do it. Bernard regarded Tavi for a moment, then he nodded toward the causeway.
Prove it then, lad. Show me.
Chapter 4 Ysanna looked up from her scrying bowl with a faintly irritated frown. That boy is going to get himself into more trouble than he can explain his way out of one day. Wan autumn sunlight streamed through the windows of Bernard Holt's main kitchen. The smell of bread baking in the wide ovens filled the room, along with the tang of the sauce sizzling on the roast, turning over the coals. Isana's back hurt from a morning's work that had begun well before the sun rose, and there wasn't going to be a chance to rest any time in the immediate future. Whenever she had a moment to spare from her preparations, she spent it focused on her scrying bowl, using Rill to keep a cautious eye upon the cordholters and Warner's folk. Warner and his sons had added their efforts to that of Elder Frederick, master of the Steadholt's Gargants, as he and his brawny son Younger Frederick cleaned out the half-buried stables of the vast beasts of labor. Cord and his youngest son lazed in the courtyard. The elder boy, Arik, had taken up an axe and had been splitting logs for the duration of the morning, burning off nervous energy with physical effort. The tension in the air throughout the morning was cloying, even to those without an ounce of watercraft in their bodies. The Hold women had fled the kitchen's heat to take their midday meal, a quick round of vegetable soup and yesterday's bread, together with a selection of cheeses they had thrown together, then taken out into the Steadhold's courtyard to eat. The weary autumn sun shone pleasantly down on the courtyard, the warmth of its flagstones sheltered from the cold north wind by Bernard Holt's high stone walls. Ysanna did not join them. The tension building in the courtyard would have sickened her, and she wanted to save back her strength and self-discipline for as long as she could, in the event that she had to intervene. So Ysanna ignored the rumble in her own belly and focused on her work, a portion of her thought reserved for her fury's perceptions.
"Aren't you going to eat, Mistress Ysanna?"
Berita looked up from where she was carelessly slicing the skins from a mound of tubers, dropping the peeled roots into a basin of water. The girl's pretty face had been lightly touched with rouge, and her already alluring eyes with coal. Ysanna had warned her mother that Berita was entirely too young for such nonsense. But there she was, holly bells in her hair and her bodice laced with deliberate wickedness beneath her breasts, more eager to admire herself in every shiny surface she could find than to help prepare the evening's banquet. Isana had gone out of her way to find chores to occupy the girl's day. Berita often enjoyed seeing young men compete with one another for her attention, and between her bodice and the sweet scent of the holly bells in her hair, she'd have them killing one another. And Isana had far too much on her mind to be bothered with any more mischief. Isana glanced at the girl, eyeing her up and down, before she reached for the poker and thrust it back into the oven, into the coals where one of two tiny fire furies that regulated the oven wasn't doing its job. She raked the poker through them, stirring them, and saw the flames dance and quiver a bit more as the sleepy fury within stirred to greater life.
"As soon as I have a moment to spare," she told the girl.
"Oh," Berita said somewhat wistfully. "I'm sure we'll be finished soon."
"Just peel, Berita."
Isana turned back to the counter and her bowl. The water within stirred and then quivered upward, resolving itself into a face. Her own, but much younger. Isana smiled warmly down at the fury. Rill always remembered what Isana had looked like the day they'd found one another, and always appeared in the same way as when Isana, then a gawky girl not quite Berita's age, had gazed down into a quiet, lovely pool.
"Rill," Isana said, and touched the surface of the water.
The liquid in the bowl curled over her finger, and then swirled around quietly in response to her.
"Rill," Isana said again. "Find Bernard."
She pressed an image from her mind, down to the fury through the contact of her finger. Her brother's sure, silent steps, his rumbling, quiet voice, and his broad hands.
"Find Bernard," she said again.
The fury quivered and swirled the water about, then departed the bowl, passing through the air in a quiet wave Isana felt prickling along her skin, and then vanished, down through the earth. Isana lifted her head and focused on Berita more sharply.
"Now then," she said. "What's going on, Berita?"
"I'm sorry?" the girl asked. She flushed bright red and turned back to her peeling, knife flashing over the tuber, stripping dark skin from pale flesh.
"I don't know what you mean, mistress."
Isana placed her hands on her hips.
"I think you do," she said, her tone crisp and severe.
"Berita, you can either tell me where you got the flowers now, or you can wait until I find out later."
Isana felt Berita's fluttering panic, dancing around on the edges of the girl's voice as she spoke.
"Honestly, mistress, I found them waiting for me at my door. I don't know who..."
"Yes, you do," Isana said. "Holly bells don't just miraculously appear, and you know the law about harvesting them. If you make me find out on my own, by the great furies, I'll see to it that you suffer whatever is appropriate anyway."
Berita shook her head, and one of the holly bells fell from her hair.
"No, no, mistress."
Isana could taste the way the lie made the girl inwardly cringe.
"I never harvested any of them. Honestly, I..."
Isana's temper flared and she snapped.
"Oh, Berita, you aren't old enough to be able to lie to me. I've a banquet to cook and a truth find to prepare for, and I've not time to waste on a spoiled child who thinks that because she's grown breasts and hips, that she knows better than her elders."
Berita looked up at Isana, flushing darker with awkward humiliation, and then snapped back with her own anger.
"Jealous, mistress?"
Isana's temper abruptly flashed from a frustrated blaze to something cold, icy. For just a moment she forgot everything else in the kitchen, all the events and disastrous possibilities that faced the Steadholt that day, and focused her attention on the buxom girl. For only a moment she lost control of her emotions and felt the old bitter rage rise within her. Every kettle in the kitchen abruptly boiled over, steam flushing out in a cloud that curved around Isana and flowed toward the girl, scalding water racing over the floor in a low wave toward her seat. Isana felt Berita's defiance transformed in an instant to terror, the girl's hands widening as she stared at Isana's face. Berita thrust her hands out as she stumbled out of her chair, the feeble wind sprites she had collected slowing the oncoming steam enough to allow her to flee.
Berita took a jumping step over the nearest arm of the onrushing water and ran toward the kitchen doors, sobbing. Isana clenched her fists and closed her eyes, wrenching her mind from the girl, forcing herself to take deep breaths to regain control of her emotions. The anger, the sheer bitter rage, howled inside her like a living thing trying to tear its way free of her. She could feel its claws scraping at her belly, her bones. She fought it down, forced it away from her thoughts, and as she did, the steam settled and spread throughout the room, fogging the thick, rough glass of the windows. The kettles calmed. The water started pooling naturally over the floor. Isana stood amidst the sweltering steam and the spilled water and closed her eyes, taking slow, deep breaths. She'd done it again. She'd let too much of the emotion she'd been feeling in another color her own thoughts, her own perceptions. Verita's insecurity and defiant anger had glided into her and taken root in her own thoughts and feelings, and she had let it happen. Isana lifted one slim hand and rubbed at her temples. The additional senses of a watercrafter felt like being able to hear another kind of sound. Sound that rubbed against one's temples like eiderdown, until she almost felt that it was grating her skull raw, that blisters would rise on her face and scalp from the sheer friction of all the emotions she felt rubbing against her. Still, there was little she could do about it now, but to control herself and to bear what came. One couldn't open one's eyes and later simply decide not to use them. She could dim the perceptions Rill's presence brought to her, but she could never shut them away altogether. It was simply a fact a watercrafter of her power had to live with. One of many, she thought. Isana crouched down, murmuring to the tiny furies in the spilled water on the floor, beckoning them until the separate puddles and droplets began running together in the center of the floor into a more coherent mass. Isana studied it, waiting for all the spare droplets to roll in from the far corners of the kitchen. The reflection of her own face looked back at her, smooth and slender, and barely older than that of a girl's. She winced, thinking of the face Rill showed her every time the fury came. Perhaps it was not so different from her own. She lifted her hand and traced her fingers over her cheek. She had a pretty face, still. Most of 40 years, and she barely looked as though she had lived 20 of them. She might look as old as 30, if she lived another 4 decades, but no older. There were no lines on her face, at the corners of her eyes, though faint shades of frost stirred in her auburn hair. Isana rose and regarded the woman reflected in the water. Tall. Thin. Too thin for a woman of her age. With scarcely any curve of hip or breast. She might have been mistaken for a gawky child. True, she may carry herself with more confidence, more strength than any child could muster. And true, the faint grey touches in her hair may have granted her an age and dignity not strictly warranted by her appearance. And true, everyone in the whole of the Calderon Valley knew her by name or sight or reputation, as one of the most formidable fury crafters in it. But that did nothing to change the simple and heartless fact that she looked like a boy in a dress. Like nothing any man would want to marry. Isana closed her eyes for a moment, pained. 37 years old and she was alone. No suitors, naturally. No garlands to wear or dances to plan for or flirtations to plot. That was all long past her, even with the apparent youth her watercrafting bestowed on her. The youth that kept her always a bit distant from the other women her age. Women with husbands. Families. She opened her eyes and idly bade the spilled water to make itself useful and clean the floor. The puddle began sweeping over it obediently, gathering up bits of dust and debris as it did, and Isana went to open the door. Cold air poured in, sharp contrast to the steamy kitchen, and she closed her eyes, taking deep, bracing breaths. She had to admit it. Birita's words had stung her. Not simply because she'd been feeling too many of the adolescent's intense emotions, but because they had rung true as well. Birita had all the luscious curves and rondure that would draw any man in the valley to her, and indeed she had half a dozen of them dancing on her strings even now, including Tavi, though the boy tried to deny it. Birita, firm and ripe and able to bear strong children. The way no one had thought Isana would ever be able to. She pressed her lips together and opened her eyes. Enough. There was too much work to be about to let an old pain rise to the surface now. Thunder rumbled over the valley's floor, and Isana crossed to the northern window, opened it, and eyed the mountain peak to the north. Gyarados loomed in all of his surly majesty there, snow already gliding further down his shoulders and toward the valley floor, warning of the coming winter. Dark clouds gathered around his head, and as she watched, they flashed with dark green lightning, sending another rumbled warning across the valley. Lilvia, then, Gyarados's wife, the storm fury, gathering up clouds for another assault on the people of the valley. She would wait all day, gathering the warmth of the sun into her cloud herds, and then send them stampeding across the valley in a rush of thunder and wind, and, like as not at this time of the year, sleet and icy rain. Isana pressed her lips together. Intolerable. If only a decently gifted windcrafter would settle down in the valley, they might blunt the worst of Thara's storms before they ever reached the Steadholts. But then any windcrafter that strong would be serving as a knight, or one of the cursers. She walked to the sink and touched the spigot, alerting the furies inside that she desired water from the well. A moment later it spilled out, cold and clear, and she filled a pair of pans before letting the furies stop the flow of it, then went around the kitchens and refilled the water in the pots that had boiled over. A moment later she took the bread from the ovens, setting it out in its pans, and slipped the next round of pans into their places. She glanced around the kitchens once more, making sure that everything was in place. The puddle was finished with the floor, so she shooed it out the door to ease into the earth beside the threshold and sink back into the ground. Rill, Isana called. What's taking so long? The water bubbled and stirred in her scrying bowl, which doubled as her mixing bowl most days, and then three little splashes announced Rill's presence. Isana crossed back to the bowl, drew her braid back over her shoulder, and regarded the surface of the water intently as the ripples stilled. The fury showed her a dim view from what must have been a stagnant pool somewhere in the pine hollows, a murky shape that could have been Bernard paced across the image in the bowl and then was gone. Isana shook her head. Rill's images were not always entirely clear, but it seemed that Bernard and Tavi were still pursuing the missing flock. She murmured a dismissal to Rill and set the bowl aside, and then noticed a sudden lack of sound from the courtyard. A breath later, the tension levels of Bernard Holt swelled into painful intensity. Isana steeled herself against the perceptions and walked briskly out of the kitchen. She kept her breathing steady and held herself with rigid confidence. The Hold folk were pressed shoulder to shoulder, facing the center of the courtyard. They were silent, but for faint mutters and worried whispers. Cord, she murmured. Isana stepped forward, and the Hold folk made way for her, clearing a narrow path through the onlookers until she could see the scene in the center of the courtyard. Two men stood facing one another in the courtyard, and the air between them practically thrummed with tension. Cord stood with his arms folded over his chest, the ground at his feet shifting and trembling. His greasy beard framed his smile sharply, and his eyes were bright and eager beneath his heavy brows. Facing him stood Steadholder Warner, a tall man, slender as a post, with gangling arms and legs, and a head that shone bald, but for a fringe of wispy grey hair. Warner's narrow, chiseled face had flushed bright red in anger, and the air around him quivered and danced like heat, rising off an oven.
"All I'm saying," Cord drawled, is that if that little slut of yours can't keep her legs together and men out from between them, it's your problem, friend, not mine.
Shut your mouth,
Warner snarled.
Or what?
Cord asked, throwing a sneer into the words.
What are you going to do, Warner? Run and hide behind the skirts of a woman and whimper for Graham to come save you?
Why, you...
Warner spat. He took a step forward, and the air in the courtyard grew detectably warmer. Cord smiled, a flash of teeth, and said,
Go ahead, Warner. Call it to Juris Macto. Let's settle this like men. Unless you'd rather humiliate your little whore by having her testify how she seduced my boy in front of every steadholder in the Calderon Valley.
One of Warner's sons, a tall and lean young man with his hair shorn in legion fashion, stepped up to his father and took his arm.
"Pa, don't," he said. "You can't take him on in a fair fight."
The other two took up a spot behind Warner while Cord's sons mirrored them behind their own father. Warner's daughter rushed to his side. Hetty's cobweb-fine hair rose and rippled in silken yellow waves in the heated air around her father. She threw a conscientious look around her, her face flaming scarlet with embarrassment.
"Papa," she urged. "No, not like this. This isn't our way."
Cord snorted at the girl.
"Bittern," he asked, glancing back at his son. "You stuck your wick in that skinny tramp. Might as well have gone after one of Warner's sheep."
Isana had to clench her fists and brace herself against the raw tide of emotions in the courtyard. From Hedy's panicky fear and humiliation to Warner's rage, to Cord's sly satisfaction and eagerness, every feeling washed over her, too intense to ignore. She forced them all away from her and took a breath. Cord's earth fury was a vicious beast, trained to kill. He used it to hunt and to slaughter his cattle. Any fury started taking on aspects of its partner after a while, but even considering Cord himself, the Earth Fury was a bad one. A killer. Isana swept a look around the courtyard. The Holdfolk all stood well clear of the conflict. None of them wanted to involve themselves in a struggle between steadholders.
Crows take her, brother! Where was he when she needed him?
The flood of intense anger from Warner grew more harsh. In only a moment more, he would give in to Cord's taunts and take the matter to Juris Macto, the realm's legal form of duel. Cord would kill him, but Warner was too furious at the treatment of his daughter to consider that. Warner's sons, too, were flooding her with a growing torrent of anger, and Cord's youngest son burned with a barely disguised lust for violence. Isana's heart fluttered with all the emotions piling on top of her own fear. She pushed them all firmly away, struggling to master them, and stalked out into the courtyard, squarely between the two men, and put her hands on her hips.
"Gentlemen," she said, letting her voice ring out, "you are interrupting lunch."
Warner took a step toward Cord, his eyes never leaving the other steadholder.
"You can't expect me to stand here and take this."
Cord sauntered forward a willing pace himself.
"Juris Macto," he said. "Just declare it, Warner, and we can settle this."
Isana spun to face Cord, meeting his eyes squarely.
"Not in my courtyard, you won't."
Bittern, behind Cord, let out a rough laugh and stepped forward toward Isana.
"Well, well," he said. "What we got here? Another little old horse standing up for whore Hetty?" "Bittern," Cord growled in warning.
Isana narrowed her eyes at Bittern. The young man's confidence, arrogance, and a sickening rush of his lust whirled over her like a foul, greasy smoke. She watched him approach, arrogantly smiling as he eyed her, from her bare feet to her long braid. The idiot evidently did not know her by sight.
"Going bad early," Bittern commented. "But I bet you'd be good for a tumble."
He reached out a hand to touch Isana's face.
Isana let him touch her for a moment, felt the desperate, arrogant need of the young man to prove himself in his own eyes. She reached up and seized his wrist and then said, voice cold, "Rill, deal with this slive." Bitan abruptly convulsed and threw himself backward onto the ground. He let out a strangled scream that cut off halfway through as clear, foaming water burst from his mouth. He thrashed on the courtyard stones in a frantic tangle of flailing limbs. His eyes bulged, and he tried to scream again, nothing but water flooding from his mouth and nose. Cord's other son rushed to his fallen brother, and Cord himself rolled forward a step with an angry snarl.
"Bitch!" he growled.
The earth bulged beneath him as though preparing to lash forward. "Go ahead, Cord," Isana said, her voice icy. "But before you do, I should remind you that you are in Bernard Holt now, and you may not challenge me to the Juris Macto." She smiled at him, as sweet and venomous as she could manage. "I'm not a steadholder."
"I can still kill you, Isana,"
Cord said. "You could," Isana replied. "But then I wouldn't be able to call Rill off of your boy there, would I?"
"And what if I could use one less mouth to feed?"
Cord answered her, showing her his teeth. "In that case," she said, "I hope you're ready to kill everyone here, because you won't get away with cold murder, Steadholder Cord. I don't care how far we are from the First Lord's justice. Kill me, and there won't be a place in the realm where you can hide." Isana promptly turned to Warner and snapped, "Wipe that smile off your face, Steadholder. What kind of behavior is this to show to my holders and their children?" She stalked toward Warner with a scowl twisting her features. "I'll have your word that you won't engage in this idiocy again while you're a guest in my home."
"Isana,"
Warner protested, he and his son still staring at Cord and his own brood.
"That animal on the ground is the one who raped my daughter."
"Papa," Hedy sobbed, tugging at Warner's sleeve. "Papa, please."
"Your word, Warner," Isana snapped, "or I'll rule against you in the truth find right here and now."
Warner's gaze snapped to Isana, and she felt his sudden shock and surprise.
"But Isana, I don't care. You can't behave this way in my home, Warner, and my brother isn't here to knock sense into your fool head. Your word. No more of this duel nonsense. No more fighting in Bernard Holt."
Warner stared at her for a moment. Isana felt the man's dismay, his anger, his helpless frustration. His gaze wavered and went to his daughter, and he softened, almost visibly.
"All right," he said quietly. "My word. For all of us. We'll start nothing."
Isana whirled back toward Cord, stalking toward the young man still choking on the ground, vomiting water. She brushed roughly past the older of Cord's sons, Arik was his name, she thought, and reached down to lay her hand on Bitan's forehead. The boy had gone beyond thought in his animal panic. There was no arrogance there now, only a fear so intense that it made Isana's skin feel cold. Cord sneered down at her.
"I guess you're going to want my word as well."
"What would be the point?" Isana snapped, keeping her voice low. "You're scum, Cord, and we both know it."
Louder, she said, "Rill, out!" She stood away as Bitan spluttered and coughed, retching more water out, finally drawing in a gasping breath of air. She left him there, coughing on the ground, and turned to go. The stone of the courtyard folded over one of her feet with a simple and almost delicate finality. Her heart fluttered with her own fear as she felt Cord's cold anger on her back. She flicked her braid over her shoulder and shot him a look through narrowed eyes.
"This isn't over, Isana,"
Cord promised, his voice very quiet.
"I won't stand for this."
Isana faced his dark stare, the cold and calculating hatred behind it, and borrowed from it, used it to steel herself against him, to return ice for ice.
"You'd best hope it's over, Cord," she said,
or you're going to think what happened to Bitan was a kindness." She flicked her eyes down to her foot and back up to him.